Tonight, recorded highlights on the subject, $50 billion. For what? The Federal Welfare Program. Now, to introduce our featured speakers, here is moderator John M. Ferrin, director of the Community Legal Assistance Office in Cambridge.
Moderators are not supposed to say too much, and I think this is probably a good tip to me, but I can't resist giving an answer to this whole subject in a couple of minutes. I came across a panacea this summer in an article that some of you may have read in The Nation magazine, the May 2nd issue. It was called A Strategy to End Poverty, and it was written by Richard Cloward and Francis Piven. And just to set the scene for a little controversy this evening, I thought, rather than struggle with any words of my own, I know better than that, I would like to read to you this panacea, which will resolve the question. Now, according to these authors, it says a vast discrepancy exists between the benefits to which people are entitled under public welfare programs and the sums which they actually receive. This gulf is not recognized in a society that is wholly and self-righteously oriented toward getting people off the welfare rolls. It is widely known, for example, that nearly 8 million persons, half of them white, now subsist on welfare. But it is not generally known that for every person on the rolls, at least one more probably meets existing criteria of eligibility but is not obtaining assistance. They go on to say that the discrepancy is not an accident stemming from bureaucratic inefficiency. Rather, it is an integral feature of the welfare system, which, if challenged, would precipitate a profound financial and political crisis. The force for that challenge and the strategy we propose, that is to say the authors propose, is a massive drive to recruit the poor onto the welfare rolls. Public welfare systems try to keep their budgets down and their rolls low by failing to inform people of the rights available to them, by intimidating and shaming them to the degree that they are reluctant either to apply or to press claims, and by arbitrarily denying benefits to those who are eligible. A series of welfare drives in large cities would, the authors believe, impel action on a new federal program to distribute income, eliminating the present public welfare system and alleviating the abject poverty which it perpetrates. By the internal disruption of local bureaucratic practices, by the furor over public welfare poverty, and by the collapse of current financing arrangements, they say, powerful forces can be generated for major economic reforms at the national level. And here it is. The ultimate objective of this strategy is to wipe out poverty by establishing a guaranteed annual income. Well, that's the panacea. And this evening we're privileged to have three honored guests speak to the subject of the federal and state welfare programs. Our first speaker is a charming lady from North Carolina, Dr. Ellen Winston, who was sworn in as the first United States Commissioner of Welfare on January in 1963. Dr. Winston had served as the Commissioner of Public Welfare for the state of North Carolina for 18 years before coming to Washington in this capacity. If you notice from the bulletin this evening, she has many degrees, she has many posts, and among her degrees, doctoral degrees, she has had them awarded by the Women's College of North Carolina, Converse College, University of North Carolina, and Springfield College. It is a real honor and a pleasure to welcome you, Dr. Winston, and I have you speak to us this evening. Dr. Ellen Winston.
Mr. Chairman, wherever you are, my fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen, I look forward to this opportunity because I always welcome any opportunity to talk about public welfare, but particularly because public welfare serves the people who most often have acute needs for legal services, little access to them, and almost always no funds to use for this purpose. The task of public welfare is to provide an ultimate guarantee against poverty and social deprivation. The basis of this mandate is the premise that no American should be permitted to live without the minimum necessities and privileges of life which are part of our culture. We hold that these essentials are rights of every citizen under the law, and that persons incapable of achieving them through their own efforts must be aided by public funds and public services. Toward this end, socially minded attorneys are making noteworthy contributions. both as members of legislative bodies and as staff members of agencies administering welfare services. When it comes to the practice of law, however, clients who can pay for counsel generally predominate in the majority of private practices. I am told, and I heard a good deal about this actually at dinner this evening, that students of numerous law schools, including Harvard, are becoming increasingly active in legal aid projects. This is certainly an encouraging development from our point of view. The fact remains, however, that far more needs to be done to protect poor people from the events which inadvertently lead to litigation and to help them to understand their rights so that they may avoid exploitation. Public welfare looks at the social needs of people much as one looks at their health needs. We are concerned as much with the prevention of family breakdown, illegitimacy, crime among the impoverished, child neglect and abuse, and other handmaidens of poverty, as we are with the correction of these social ills to the extent that our resources enable us to do so. It is in this aspect of public welfare that we would hope to stimulate a far greater involvement on the part of the legal profession. The topic you have selected for tonight's discussion, $50 billion for what, points me to point out that this figure is more than 10 times the current appropriation for the Welfare Administration. Our budget is 4.7 billion dollars for fiscal 1967. It is utilized to provide basic support and services for the 8 million Americans who are the poorest of the poor. Families and their children whose deprivation includes poor housing, poor health, poor education, and poor employment opportunity. This money reaches people in need through various programs of grants and aid to the states and is augmented considerably by state and local funds. It is, of course, not the only federal money being used to alleviate poverty. However, I think it is no exaggeration to say that it represents the nation's largest attempt to date to coordinate the many types of assistance needed by people in every locality in these United States with multiple complex problems all interrelated. This new direction in public welfare gained impetus with the 1962 amendments to the Social Security Act. During the previous 25 years, the emphasis had been mainly on providing very minimal incomes to help those at the bottom of the economic ladder following the Great Depression. The 1962 amendments, however, recognized that money payments alone were not providing an escape from poverty. Hence, the program of federal grants and aid to the states for public assistance was expanded specifically to include funds for social services, including legal services. We now find that our more progressive local public welfare agencies are deeply engaged in comprehensive programs which seek to attack the wide range of social factors which cause and perpetuate the conditions of poverty. And I say this recognizing that there is tremendous range from the more progressive agencies to the ones which have advanced very little, really, from the philosophy of the Elizabethan poor laws. Extensive social legislation in recent years has provided new tools for this task, albeit still insufficient. The 1965 amendments to the Social Security Act offer a case in point. The portions of these amendments administered by the Welfare Administration are those which first increase the federal share in basic public assistance payments effective January 1st of this year and liberalize the income exemption standards for three public assistance categories: the recipients of aid to families with dependent children, aid to the permanently and totally disabled, and old age assistance. Second, create under Title V a broad new program of comprehensive health services for children. And third, establish under Title 19 Medicaid a program of federal aid to the states for medical services to public assistance recipients and other low-income individuals and families. The Medicare amendments of 1965, Title 18, also affect public welfare by releasing for other social welfare needs some of the funds previously used for medical services to the aged. The health amendments in particular reflect the nation's growing recognition that high-quality medical care is one of the fundamental rights, along with food, shelter, and clothing, of all citizens. Surely, no investment in the nation's welfare can pay greater dividends than an investment in the health of our children. I'm particularly gratified, therefore, by the fact that we now have authority under Title V
to expand our existing child health programs by granting funds to poverty target areas for comprehensive health services, plus treatment when needed, for preschool and school-aged children whose parents cannot pay for these services themselves. Title 19 also permits the states to obtain federal funds for medical services for the children of public assistance and other low-income families. I want to discuss this new medical assistance program in some detail because it requires a high degree of planning between health and welfare agencies and because it lays groundwork for future improvements in our entire public assistance system. Title 19 sets a high goal to be achieved within a limited time span. The goal is the elimination of the financial barriers which now deprive many people of the scope and quality of medical care they need. The date for achieving the goal is set forth in the law, 1975. As these programs get underway, and 25 states, as well as Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, already have programs which have been approved for federal aid, it becomes apparent that broad-gauge planning, which involves many organizations and many professional disciplines, is imperative. While the law calls for administration by a single state agency, that agency must draw upon outside skills and competencies in developing and carrying out a workable program. If the public welfare agency administers the program, and this is the pattern in most states, it must look to the health department for extensive cooperation in the establishment and enforcement of standards of care. If the public health department is the administrative agency, it must rely upon the welfare department for setting up and enforcing a system to assure that the services reach those who are eligible. Others who must be involved at the outset are the providers of services. That is why we are requiring that there be advisory committee with representatives from the physicians, the dentists, the administrators of hospitals and nursing homes, as well as others whose services and facilities are essential. Unless they have a voice in the planning, understand the program, and endorse its goals, the full potentialities of this progressive legislation can never be realized. We also expect that states will include on their advisory committees people who can speak from the consumer viewpoint. The medical assistance program thus affords unusual opportunity for teamwork between the general public and the various professional disciplines. And we know that such cooperation is today basic to the resolution of all major social welfare issues. There are certain features of this federal law that I want to mention. First, a state must adopt the new program by January 1, 1970, if it wishes to continue to receive federal funds to help defray the cost of medical care for persons receiving public assistance. The federal financial participation is quite generous and ranges from 50% of the cost in states with generally high incomes to as much as 83% in the poorer states. The unfortunate fact is the states that get 50% can afford the new programs and the states that only have to put up 17% can't. Coverage is extended to three broad groups of people. First, those who receive financial assistance under the federal state programs of public assistance. Second, comparable groups in the population, namely the aged, the blind, the disabled, and families with dependent children who could qualify for public assistance, except that they are considered to have enough money to live on, but who cannot afford to pay for medical expenses. And third, all children under 21, including children and youth whose parents work and who thus would not be covered in the second grouping, whose families cannot afford to pay for the medical care of the young people in the family need. The federal law requires that the program include only five specific services: inpatient hospital care, outpatient care, physician services, skilled nursing home care for adults, and laboratory and x-ray services. In practice, however, most states have gone beyond these minimums and include drugs, prosthetic devices, and other items that are obviously essential to a medical care program. Many also include some type of dental care. Some features of the federal law are significant, not only as they relate to this specific program, but also because they represent innovations in our approaches to the problems of poor people, which may have implications for other social welfare programs. The most discussed, of course, is the concept of establishing a basic income level, which is recognized as necessary to meet ordinary living expenses so that whatever medical expenses may be incurred, that basic income need not be drawn upon. Each state sets its own levels, and except in New York, where the income levels are considerably higher than those set by other states, this feature has raised no questions. In other words, this would seem to indicate a general acceptance of the concept of an income floor, which should be protected against vicissitudes that might otherwise force people to live below it. Another important feature is the elimination of durational residence requirements. Another, the limitations placed upon the responsibility of relatives. For example, grown children cannot be held responsible for the medical expenses of their aged parents, and simplified methods for determining eligibility. Such innovations in existing law take on added significance when we relate them to the proposals for redirection of our present public assistance and child welfare programs, which were recently issued by the Advisory Council on Public Welfare in their report to the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. It is this report, having the power, we have the duty. Although the Council devoted only a small portion of its report to medical care programs, what is striking is the similarity in basic approaches which characterize both the 1965 legislation and the Council report. Moreover, since the Council report drew very heavily upon testimony from hundreds of people in all walks of life, taken at public hearings in all parts of the country, I think we might conclude that these approaches indicate a trend in public thought about crucial social issues which may profoundly affect the shape of social welfare programs generally, and particularly public welfare programs in the years ahead. The Council's report offers a middle ground approach to such issues as guaranteed incomes, carrying forward many of the economic concepts of the 1930s, but also questioning traditional attitudes in the light of complex current social problems. For example, the Council believes the social insurances should be the bedrock of protection against economic need. They believe that with more liberal benefits paid through the old age, survivors, disability, and hospital insurance program, and with substantial improvement in both coverage and payments in the unemployment insurance program, many of the people now dependent on public assistance, as well as other poor people, particularly the more employable of the unemployed, can be maintained at a decent standard of living. The improvement of minimum wage laws should further assist millions of full-time workers who do not now earn enough to maintain an adequate living standard. However, despite these depression-initiated reforms, the Council foresees a residue of economic need. The worker with too large a family, the chronically unemployed, the broken families headed by women, plus others who, for various reasons, would not be eligible for Social Security or other benefits sufficient to support an adequate living standard. For these, the Council recommends use of the public assistance programs to assure adequate incomes. To achieve this, however, the Council recognized that the present public assistance programs would require major overhauling. One recommended revision is that the federal government establish a national standard for adequacy of income. While allowances could be made for regional variations in living costs, the standard would be applied nationwide, with the federal government making up the difference between that part of the cost a specific state could afford to pay and the amount needed to meet the standard. Such a revision would not only raise the public assistance payments in all states, all of which at present are insufficient to support even a so-called poverty level of living, but would be of particular help to the poorest states, many of which are currently investing a relatively high proportion of their income in public assistance, but have so little money and so many poor that payments are sometimes barely enough to sustain life, averaging, for example, about $8 per person today in Mississippi per month. The Council would also eliminate the separate programs which serve different groups of needy. One program for the aged, another for the blind, a third for the disabled, a fourth for families with children, and a catch-all program of general assistance, financed with state funds, local funds, or both, to help those who do not fit into any of the four federally aided programs. The rigid definitions of who qualifies for each of these separate programs eliminate, as has already been pointed out, an estimated two-thirds of the people who, on the basis of their poverty alone, would qualify for assistance. The Council advocates replacement of these separate programs with a single program with a single eligibility requirement, namely need. The Council proposes further that the guarantee of an adequate income be handled through public welfare agencies under the public assistance program, rather than through some less personal mechanism such as a negative income tax. Public welfare would be every community's and every neighborhood's focal point for the broad range of human services needed to counteract the dehumanizing trends of modern society. Persons requiring financial aid would be but one of many groups these agencies would serve. And in addition to providing them with enough income to maintain a wholesome living standard, the agency would provide a variety of other services, some designed to enable them to earn adequate incomes, others designed to remove cultural or other barriers to their absorption into the mainstream of American life. Similar services would also be given, although not necessarily without charge, to persons who receive their incomes from other sources, including wages and social insurance benefits, some of whom, despite adequate incomes, would otherwise live at substandard levels. Help with money management, housekeeping practices, child rearing, and other services is frequently needed if people who have been scarred by years of extreme deprivation are to accept a middle-class culture and value system. The Council is not unaware of the increased number of functions its recommendations would create for our already understaffed, overworked public welfare agencies. However, they believe that time now spent in investigations of eligibility and endless paperwork could be saved once need and need alone becomes the single standard of eligibility. Other savings could be achieved by simplifying the process of applying for assistance to require only a simple declaration of income status. It is recognized, however, that simply changing the nature of the work performed by existing public welfare staffs is only a partial answer to the problem of equipping public welfare agencies to offer an adequate program of public social services. The report, therefore, calls for vast expansion of schools of social work and increased federal aid to finance the recruitment of both professional and auxiliary personnel. Finally, the Council is emphatic that all welfare programs which receive federal funds must protect certain basic rights of needy persons. First, the right to apply and receive prompt, objective, and impartial determination of eligibility for and provision of benefit or service. Second, the right to be given a fair hearing against unacceptable judgments by an impartial appeals agent. Third, the right to representation in appeals by an attorney whose services and costs would be compensated by the agency if not otherwise provided for. Fourth, the right to court review. And fifth, the obligation on the agency to publicize the conditions of entitlement to all benefits and services. The right to services would be conditioned on the need for service rather than on income level. Although these rights are set forth or implied in the Social Security Act and are reinforced by welfare administration policies, they are not sustained equally by all of the states. For example, promptness may mean within 30 days in some states or longer. Others can provide immediate assistance within 24 hours. In general, the Council believes that the present standards of promptness are clearly too slow. Again, the right to a fair hearing. This applies particularly to the right of an individual to put before the state agency any claim that his application for assistance has been delayed or denied without justification. In such cases, the state is required to provide applicants with an understandable procedure by which they may take appropriate steps to express their dissatisfaction with the agency's action or failure to act. Written notification to the claimant of his right to a fair hearing is required at the time he applies for aid and also in connection with each agency action on his claim. Furthermore, applicants must be notified in writing that assistance has been authorized at an established amount or, if it has been denied, the agency's reason for denial. Recognizing that the appeals decisions represent the final action of the state agency, the Council nevertheless points out that the individual should also have the opportunity for judicial review of his claim. Although representation by counsel has always been permissible, the Council believes that, and I quote, absence of any provisions for payments for legal services may well be one reason why relatively few decisions have been taken to the courts. During the past year, the Welfare Administration informed the states that we were in a position to provide federal funds to pay a share of the cost of representation by counsel for claimants who wish to appeal agency decisions. I wish I could tell you that the state welfare administrators began immediately to line up outside my door. However, they have not done so. Therefore, we welcome the emphasis in this momentous report on the need to review present practices and to encourage and make available legal services to clients, both for appeals before the agency and to the courts as well. There are other general recommendations which I shall not elaborate upon because I hope you will want to study the Advisory Council's report in its entirety. When you do, I feel certain that you will agree with me that it provides a challenging blueprint for the future of public welfare. Needless to say, if the Council's recommendations are to materialize in programs of action, we shall need widespread understanding and support from the public as well as from the professional groups to whom we must turn for help in delivering more effective services to people. There is another new direction in public welfare which I find exciting and which goes hand in hand with the Council's concepts of comprehensive welfare services, readily available when they are needed and where they are needed. This is the growing movement across the country and especially in our cities to decentralize social services and place them directly inside the community neighborhoods or rural areas where they are most acutely needed. You may be familiar with some of the patterns which are being tested in many communities throughout the nation. These range from quite simple information and referral centers located in low-income neighborhoods where the needs for a broad range of health, welfare, legal, and other services are urgent to much more comprehensive centers. Whereas the information and referral center puts the client in touch with one or more of the services he needs, the comprehensive center is equipped to provide most of the services in a single location. It also is prepared to follow through when additional referrals have to be made to see that the required service has actually been provided the client. Ideally, one envisions center units which house a variety of public and voluntary services with a center manager to assure that the providers of the service do indeed coordinate their activities around the needs of a single client or family. As yet, such centers are few in number and still somewhat limited in scope. Among the most comprehensive are those which have been established in some public housing projects. In these, the public welfare agency has staff to provide social services, the employment office staff provides employment counseling and job placement services, a social security employee helps with social insurance problems, health needs are met through clinics or public health nursing services, and certain other services may be included. Several such centers are located in housing projects for the aged, blind, or disabled. The purpose here is to prolong independent living by also providing homemaker services, meals on wheels, visiting nurse, and other home health services so that people who are unable to care for themselves can nevertheless remain in their own homes and avoid dependency on institutional care. During the past few months, the New York City Department of Public Welfare has begun to open a series of satellite centers, bringing the services of the department directly into some of the city's slum neighborhoods. The first was located in West Harlem. Although operated solely by the welfare department, the services these satellite centers offer are quite extensive, including financial assistance, homemaker and daycare services, legal counseling, and aid with job training and employment problems. An important feature of these centers is that they are equipped to give emergency services on an around-the-clock basis, weekends as well as weekdays. The Neighborhood Multiple Service Center is our best protection against the danger of fragmentation of services. And recently, I wrote the administrators of public welfare in all the states to stress the urgency of need for such centers and to point out how federal funds can be used to help finance them. The Welfare Administration is also preparing guidelines for all state welfare agencies. These will suggest ways to get comprehensive service centers started and methods of building an increasingly broad range of service into the center programs. It is my hope that legal services will be given a high priority, for we know that the conditions of poverty, the crippling economic and social conditions, and their resultant sense of resentment and hopelessness are made even less bearable by the legal problems which frequently arise. For several years, our Office of Juvenile Delinquency and Youth Development provided support for legal service units in several comprehensive community action projects. The purpose was to demonstrate how these units might help reduce some of the problems of poverty, which are related tangentially, at least, to juvenile delinquency. The first of these demonstration projects were located in economically deprived areas in New York City, New Haven, Boston, and Washington. In each instance, some affiliation with local university law schools was provided. No two projects were alike, but their objectives were similar. One of their most important contributions was to render legal services to persons who had never before had access to lawyers. Furthermore, the projects demonstrated that there were many areas of unmet legal need which had not previously been recognized, many innovative ways to use the skills of lawyers, and many new approaches to resolving legal problems, often with the result of affecting basic changes in legal and social institutions. By giving poor people ready access to lawyers when needed, the project sought to develop a new sense of respect for the law and its agents in the low-income community where legal institutions and procedures are traditionally viewed with hostility and suspicion. Many questions remain about the present state of public welfare law, about the administration of justice, the proper role of the legal profession, and about needed improvements in existing legal aid and other social service programs. We need your creative thinking to help us get creative answers.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Winston. Our next speaker is a very affable gentleman, as you will notice, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, his friends call him Pat. And he is presently the professor of education and urban politics at Harvard in the School of Education. He came on July 1 of this year as the director of the Joint Center for Urban Studies at MIT and at Harvard. In 1963, President Kennedy appointed him as United States Assistant United States Secretary of Labor. And prior to coming to Harvard, he was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Studies at Wesleyan University. Glad to welcome Professor Moynihan this evening.
Dr. Winston, Professor Banfield, I rise to correct a misapprehension which many of you have been foisted on all of us, I suppose, concerning the true identity of our chairman, whose initials got so very considerably garbled. And it perhaps is best for me to tell you that this man is in fact a representative of FERIN, that is Family Enrichment Resources Rehabilitation and Entertainment Notions. Now, as I look about me at the pagan adornment of this Richardsonian hall, it occurs to me that some of you may think this has to do with birth control devices, but this is not the case. And I, in any event, am asked to speak about welfare, and I think I look out and am considering the problems of people who are dependent upon the benefactions of others and look to higher authorities for guidance and depend upon them for reassurance. And considering my audience, I think of the Irish lady who was seen leaving church in something of a huff, with babes in arms, a little brood following her, leaving an occasion where a newly ordained Dominican was preaching his first sermon on the joys of family life. And as this lady left, she was heard to say, "I wished I knew as little about the subject as that young man." I'm going to speak to you, I hope briefly, and as frankly as I can, and with nothing like the order of information or logic that Dr. Winston brought to us from a more orderly and logical capital of government as against learning, which is a very different thing, as you know. I'm going to try to answer the questions as put to us. In the first case, $50 billion for what? And it seems to me important that all of you who are going to live your lives in such bureaucracies might as well find out now in advance, rather to your profit, rather than later to your sorrow, that the first thing any bureaucracy spends $50 billion for is for itself. And the $50 billion that is spent on welfare is, first of all, and most of all, for the welfare workers. And if you don't know that, you don't know bureaucracy. And if you don't know bureaucracy, you're not at the Harvard Law School. So, I didn't know that. I thought it was for poor people. And some years after President Kennedy appointed me, as our representative from FERIN has indicated, I undertook to do something, as I thought, in such are the misguided notions of a meteorist in the sub-cabinet, I thought I would do something for Negro families. And I wrote a report about them. And I wrote a report in fairly dead seriousness. And I said that in an effort to pick up from that point which the last great Negro scholar in America and one of the greatest scholars any America has known, E. Franklin Frazier, to pick up from his book, The Negro Family, which was published in 1939, which he left off with a very dour and solemn prediction that a untrained and unprepared peasant people was heading for the cities of destruction, as he called them. And in those cities, their families would break up, and they would be forced to depend upon welfare, and would become the objects of disdain and resentment. And to see what had happened to Frazier's forecast. And in a very short order, and with some foreknowledge, as you would imagine, but with more surprise as the data was assembled than anything I had anticipated, I came to learn that, as it seemed to me, that Frazier had been right. That in fact the great migration to the cities in our time and the extended unemployment that had accompanied that migration and the extremely bad housing and the deprivation of many of the normal resources of community that had been accompanied it had in fact produced a very high level of social disorganization among the urban Negro people of our nation, a level of disorganization which one can encounter in many industrial states and industrial nations at different times, and which, if you know the history of the 19th century in America, was very easily to be encountered then. But this came at a time of galloping expectation, at a time when such matters were very much at contrast with the progress and the normal developments of the rest of the nation. And it seemed to me that these events were such as fairly clearly were heading the United States for a period of very considerable urban unrest, violence, antagonism, trouble. And I wrote a simple report, which the first lines were simply that the United States is heading for a new crisis in race relations. And as was the responsibility, I speak now as a person who did not reveal these events have simply been made public. As was the normal course of events, I wrote this up. It's made its way to the White House. It was accepted as a proposition. And on the 4th of June in 1965, the President of the United States went to Howard University to a commencement occasion and made what I think is generally accepted, the most advanced commitment to the issue of the equality of the Negro American that any president has ever made in history. He said, "We are not going to let this great moment stop just where it stopped 100 years ago, giving the Negroes liberty and doing nothing about giving them equality." He said, "Our goal is equality as a fact and as a result, and that we are not going to attain that equality until we bring the conditions of life for the Negro people, principally the conditions of life as best symbolized, as best evoked in its totality in the conditions of their family life, to equality and a parity with the rest of the nation." And he pledged his administration to do that, and he did so at one of that rarest of moments, which had not occurred 5 times in the history of the American Republic, when a president who wished to do such a thing had the votes, had the money, had the support of the nation. Now, 19 months later, when it was all over, and it's all over now, that initiative is in ruins. Nothing came of it whatever. The votes are gone, the money is gone, the goodwill is gone. And I'd like you to know, and I'm not, because it came as much a surprise to me as it came to the person who did it, Professor Lee Rainwater at Washington University, a very distinguished American sociologist, and a colleague, William Yancey, have written a book about this, which will be published this spring by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press. And they said, "How did this happen? Where did the trouble begin?" And they said, and they came to a conclusion which Arthur Schlesinger came almost identical conclusion in terms of President Kennedy's problems in foreign policy. The trouble began with the permanent government of the United States. In this case, the trouble began in the welfare administration of the Department of AGW. With the permanent bureaucracy, Dr. Winston is not one of those persons. She's one of us. God bless her. And she's a Democrat to both. And a lady beyond all things. But it was the permanent bureaucracy of the federal government which, in defiance of its president, in defiance of its political executives, went outside, went to the civil rights movement, went to the far left, and said, these facts are lies. These men are racists. This is an evil conspiracy to do you in. Because they thought it was an effort to do them in. And that is the fundamental law of bureaucracy. They defied their president, they destroyed his initiative, and if you will allow me, they did a great disservice to the American people, but they did it in the preservation of their bureaucratic interests. They had been challenged by the presidential government, and once again they showed the presidential government that they, in the end, had the power to destroy any initiative. And indeed they did it. And now they have a legislature which will not trouble them with many further initiatives for some time to come. Now, I'd like to suggest to you that this kind of thing does not arise just out of the normal noxiousness of bureaucracy, but out of a particular set of interests which are characteristic of the American approach to welfare, and which Lee Rainwater, in another context, in the Professor Rainwater, in his testimony this week to the Ribbicott Committee in Washington, described as a fundamental characteristic of our welfare system and a problem, I think, about it, which is that he's described our present system as involving a strategy of services as against a strategy of income. And I think even in what Dr. Winston has said, and Dr. Winston is certainly one of the most distinguished, and God knows we loved her, and I still do. And I shall. And if you knew her, you would know why, really. The fact is that for curious historical reasons, which I think have not been very carefully studied, but which ought to be, the American notion of how to handle public welfare problems and how to handle the problems of dependent groups and lower class groups arose in terms of changing those people, of doing something for them so that they would subsequently act differently and no longer be dependent. Counsel them, train them, reassure them, psychoanalyze them, pebble up, and do so at all means at $16,000 a year per social worker. Note, it is an absolutely preoccupation that the way to help poor people is to hire people who aren't poor to help poor people. That is a process known as feeding the sparrows by feeding the horses. And it is an But it is our preoccupation. And one of the things I think that does, in fact, it does reveal, if you want to think about a historical process, is that these techniques, in fact, do have a very high impact in terms of the man-person-to-person relationship. Don't doubt that for a moment. It's a very real one. The problem is coverage. I think Peter Rossi has made this distinction. You have a nation of 195 million people. You have, I don't know, what, 14,000 social workers. One to one, they could do a lot, you know. Who was that fellow who was on the end of a log? Mark Hopkins on one end of a log and one student on the other. That's sort of that was an original 19th century ideal of education. It remains our ideal of how to maintain a stable society of 190 million people. And there aren't that many Mark Hopkins, and there never were. I'll give you, and the thing that is so troubling to an intellectual, if there's an intellectual about it, is that we persist in some of these patterns in the face of a mounting level of evidence, and I think a good level of good evidence, that these things really don't work very well.
that large-scale efforts intended with large to have large impact, in fact, in general, have a very low level of impact. And to step outside the welfare role for just a minute, although we've early learned that education is welfare too, since rich people can afford their own, and therefore if you get it for free, it must be something wrong with you. We have had, for instance, a series of these things. We had a Head Start began about 2 years ago. And it had quite dramatic impacts on children very quickly, but our research in it showed that these impacts attenuated very quickly. All right, what to do about that? Well, we most recently saw that Mr. Shriver suggested that we should have a project called Project Keep Going. The principal element in Project Keep Going is that we would reduce the pupil-teacher ratio in the nation to 15 to 1, and that would keep you going. And today, or yesterday, the Commissioner of Education, a very distinguished and important man, Dr. Howe, said he endorsed that idea. It has some small effects in language. It has some small effects in the job satisfaction of teachers, but that's all. The Coleman study this summer, the second largest social science research project in the history of the world, did not even have a chart on the effects of achievement to be derived from teacher-pupil ratio because, as it said, for all groups, in all conditions, in all regions, the effect was zero. And yet we have two principal offices in the United States government, notably associated with welfare activities, saying in the face of everything which intellect has tried to determine in the way of how to expend public scarce resources in the best way, do it this way even so. Now, are they interested in the pupils or are they interested in the teachers? No. Now, I'd like to leave you with two thoughts. One is that the issue of welfare and welfare dependency in America is a very serious one and not a funny one because it goes to the heart of the disadvantaged position of the Negro in America. The biggest and ugliest domestic political issue in this country is Negro dependent on welfare. And this is a fact. If you don't think it is a fact, you should have been in California in the last month, where every stop Governor-elect Reagan made, he told a little story. He said, do you know, he said, did you hear about the lady who called up the welfare office and she said her baby didn't have a crib to sleep in? The welfare worker said, oh my goodness, it's terrible, madam. Your baby doesn't have a crib to sleep in? Where is sleeping? And the mother said, why, she's sleeping in the box the color television set came in. And it was a smash and he won by 1,000,000 votes. And let me tell you, if Mr. Cloward's strategy to end poverty had made its way across the country in time, he'd have won by 2,000,000 votes. Because this is a source of tremendous inequality of Negro Americans. And it is a system we've forced upon them. We've almost singled them out to be a welfare-dependent people. And one of the things the Welfare Administration has said in the process of doing it is to say, we will deny any guilt for doing it, but because we won't keep any statistics by race. And so the Welfare Administration has almost no statistics by race, therefore they don't know that every time you talk about a welfare mother in America, the politicians say it, the people know you mean Negro, and there are enough ugly people and ugly politicians to take advantage of this in this country, and if you don't think so, look at the returns from the last election. This is an ugly, dangerous thing in America, and it's growing, and it could spoil this country. And if we don't do something about it, we are going to have ourselves to blame. Now, there's no need to create a dependent class. It is perfectly possible in this country to have the simple measures of income redistribution, which go automatically and as a matter of right, not to require anybody to declare themselves dependent, to put themselves in a position of dependency upon other people that can be so easily exploited. We are the only industrial democracy in the world without a family allowance. The reason we don't have a family allowance is because it doesn't take any welfare workers to administer it.
You could run a family allowance in this country with 200 people in the Social Security offices in Baltimore. In a simple, straightforward per capita allowance for children, which is the fundamental weakness of most of the dependent people in this country. Those who are not fundamentally in a family situation are in a situation of age or illness of the kind that nobody ever seriously resents or talks about. Now, it seems to me either we're going to come to our senses on this thing, or we are going to walk our way into a state in which the capacity of the American people for bitterness, for resentfulness, and for racism will scare us all. Now, I don't want to leave you on that level, but I just want to suggest to you that even the title of our program tonight suggests to you the idea that we spend $50 billion a year on welfare is outrageous. And you heard earlier the discussion that Social Security was described as welfare. Social Security is an absolutely solvent insurance system. Not a penny goes in that doesn't go out that doesn't come in. Describe that as welfare is to describe General Motors as welfare. And that indeed you have. And finally, I have been given, as a matter of fact, a suggestion by a note has been sent to me by the agent from Ferrin that says that man Silver is nothing of the kind. This man's name isn't Silver. He is, in fact, another agent of a group, the initials of which stand for Slippery, Insinuating, Libelous, Uxorious Evasions of Reality. Now, let us put an end to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Moynihan. I started to make up some homily about Moynihan from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but I decided that I shouldn't even start that. I think it should be clear to first-year law students that this is not the Moynihan who wrote that celebrated Horn book entitled Feudal Estates. Our next speaker is another popular entertainer from the Harvard community. In fact, I'm told he has more auditors than he has people taking his course. I don't know how that cuts, but we're delighted to have Professor Edward C. Banfield, the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Urban Government, a member of the faculty of the Public Administration here. He has been at Harvard since 1961, and prior to that time, he was at the University of Chicago, where he was an associate professor in political science. He's written a number of interesting books, the most interesting of which by title is The Moral Basis of a Backward Society, which I hope he will comment on. And his most recent book is City Politics. We're delighted to have Professor Edward Banfield with us this evening.
Moderator and fellow panelists, those bad bureaucrats in Washington may have done the Negro in and done the American people in, but they did good for the Joint Center of Urban Studies. However, they did bad for me, because he just made my speech. I really did. What's worse than making my speech? He made it better than I could make it. Well, I think there are two welfare problems in this country. They are overlapping, but they're nevertheless separate and ought to be considered separately. The first, let us say, is the problem of the money poor. The people who have nothing wrong with them except they don't have money enough. They are mostly old, disabled, mothers with dependent children, employed workers with large families and low incomes, and the unemployed. The other welfare problem, which needs to be distinguished from this, although it overlaps considerably, I'll refer to as the problem of the culturally poor. These are people who are also money poor, but this is not their only problem or indeed their main problem. They would have the same problems if their incomes doubled or tripled, we have reason to suppose. Their style of life is the style of squalid poverty, not simply because their incomes are low, but because their standards are low. Now, the problem of the money poor is really pretty simple, it seems to me. The solution to the problem is employ the employable, maintain a very high level of aggregate demand, have jobs enough to go around. For those who can't work because they're not employable, the aged, the disabled, the mothers with dependent children, and so on, raise their income to an adequate level by transferring income from those who have it to those who need it. Now, there are many ways of doing this. We're doing it on a large scale now. I don't know whether the $50 billion has any legitimacy, but whatever the figure is, it would be quite possible within the existing structure to take care of most of these people very simply by simply raising the amounts that are involved. My own predilection would be in favor of the so-called negative income tax or guaranteed annual family income of some kind, which Dr. Winston apparently feels is too personal, or rather not personal enough, meaning I take it that if people are given the income and allowed to spend it as they please, the opportunities will not be very good to try to educate or rehabilitate them or mold their behavior. My feeling is that these people know how to spend their money as well as you or I, most of them. What they need is not education, training, rehabilitation, but money. Now, this problem, the money poor problem, is in a sense insoluble. For as long as we don't have perfect income equality in this country, some people will always be at the bottom of the scale. And if we define being poor as being in, say, the bottom two-fifths or one-fifth or whatever, there will always be people in the bottom one-fifth as long as incomes aren't equal. So no matter how high incomes are in absolute terms, there will presumably be some at the bottom, and these may always be defined as poor, and in this sense, the income, the money poor problem, is an insoluble one. Well, now let's take the culturally poor. They are a very much more difficult and I think a very much more serious matter because the solutions are not at hand. We tend to assume that the culturally poor are so because we have discriminated against them on racial grounds, or some people seem to think because they there is a subculture peculiar to them as members of a race or ethnic group, or there are those who think that they are culturally handicapped because they live in what are called slum ghettos. Big cities. Well, now it seems to me that theory falls afoul of some pretty well-established facts. I'd like to quote a few sentences that I've picked out here and there from the book by the sociologist Hollingshead, Elmtown's Youth. Elmtown was a typical, as Hollingshead calls it, a typical Midwestern town of about 6,000 population. The description that he gives of it is as of about 1940-41. The population of Elmtown included, I believe, one Negro family, which wasn't in the sample studied. The people of Elmtown are not foreigners. They are not ethnics. They were, for the most part, Protestants, Americans of old family. The class 5 people are the ones at the bottom of the scale. Class 5 means lower class, lower, lower class. And here are a few sentences about this typical Midwest American, all-American town. Class 5 families are excluded from the two leading residential districts. 92% are unskilled and semi-skilled. Privacy is almost non-existent. Bath and toilet facilities are found in approximately one home in seven. They will leave a job casually, often without notice, for flimsy reasons. Employers do not like to hire them unless labor is scarce or they can be induced to work for low wages. 8% of the mothers and 46% of the fathers had been convicted once or more in the local courts. Serial monogamy is the rule. Serial monogamy, that means having your women one after another. One-fifth to one-fourth of all births are illegitimate. The mean number of children is 5.6 per mother. Vicious fights followed by desertion by either the man or the woman, possibly divorce, are not unusual. The burden of child care as well as support falls on the mother more often. Class 5 persons are almost totally isolated from organized community activities. They know that their children, they knew that their children were discriminated against in the school system by both the teachers and the pupils. The Class 5s get the bad jobs, such as helping in the junkyards and hauling garbage and ashes. Class 5 persons give the impression of being resigned to a life of frustration and defeat in a community that despises them. So you see, you don't have to have a black skin or be an ethnic to be a pariah in America. Well, efforts have been made to restore the self-respect of people in this pariah status for a long while. People who have thought about these matters have theorized for more than a century that the trouble might be that these people had somehow been pushed out or got out of a right relation to society and to their fellow men, and that the problem was for society to get them back into a right relation with it. And there have been repeated efforts, intelligent efforts and well-intentioned efforts to restore such people to a right relation with society, beginning with the friendly visitor movement or the charity movement of more than a century ago, and right up to and including the present community organization movement. But as far as I can see, all of these efforts have failed. They failed one after another. As far as I can see, there's no record of any success anywhere. The function of the schools, the public schools, has always been to make clear to the children of such families that they are lower class. Not to educate them, not to assimilate them into the middle class or the working class, but to make plain to them that they are pariahs and what pariah status is. That hasn't changed, although we've tried in recent years earnestly in places to make it change. As far as I've been able to discover, Higher Horizons hasn't changed that, and neither has Head Start. Social workers have not had any success in rehabilitating the so-called culture of poverty people, the multi-problem families, the hard-to-reach families. I don't think you can produce any record of success with the really hard cases. The truth of the matter is that nobody knows how to change culture and personality according to plan. Very doubtful that even if we knew how, we could do so or would want to do so in a free country. After all, being lower class is not a crime. It's a bit hard to see how we can undertake to remake people's style of life in a country where these people are fellow citizens and, incidentally, voters. Well, in the past, the lower class did not increase very much, presumably because of the high infant mortality rates. They died off. That seems to have changed. The high mortality rates, infant mortality rates, have been reduced. Mortality rate among Negro males, the Negro male is not to be equated with the member of the lower class, but nevertheless, it's well known that Negroes fall into the lower income group to a large extent, and these figures are perhaps roughly indicative of what's happened throughout the lower income group. Mortality rate among Negro males under 1 year of age fell from 101.2 per thousand in 1940 to 59.9 per thousand in 1950 to 44.8 per thousand in 1963. So I suppose there's reason to expect that these figures are as I believe they are, indicative of the lower income and lower class group across the board, that the numbers of such people in our society may increase considerably. What's the answer? One answer that is being pushed, of course, and I suppose the answer that will be pushed for some time to come, is birth control. Conference of Catholic bishops protested 2 or 3 weeks ago, as I suppose you all recall, the alleged coercion of welfare clients. And a few days later, Mayor Lindsay of New York told the press that he had urged the state of New York to permit the welfare department workers to give information to clients even if they had not asked for it, which I took to be a clear indication from the mayor that he was not concerned particularly about coercion. It's not clear to me that coercion will work in these cases. I don't have any doubt that the welfare workers will try to coerce whatever the mayor and the governor tell them. But I'm not sure they can make it work, because what have they got to threaten the lower class person with? All they can do, it seems to me, is threaten to withhold extras of some kind. It's perfectly clear that our society is not going to let anybody starve because he has some children without the authorization of the welfare workers. And the welfare workers and the clients know that. All the welfare workers can do to bring pressure on these people is to make their lives miserable by harrying them and harassing them, but their lives are miserable anyway, and I think they are used to dealing with welfare workers. Furthermore, they don't care about the extras. The little things, the added income that the welfare worker has it in his or her discretion to give or withhold. They don't care about these extras. That, indeed, is to a considerable extent the problem. Would that they did care about extras. Would that they were motivated to want more and demand more. Well, what's the answer? The anthropologist Oscar Lewis implies that the answer is revolution. He says there's no culture of poverty in socialist countries, as far as he's been able to see. Well, you may consider that that is too high a price to pay for fundamental change. Well, another possibility would be to change middle-class culture fundamentally in order to bring about a change ultimately in the response of the lower class to the middle class. But that's not an easy thing to do either. I don't see any more reason to suppose that we can change middle-class culture according to plan than to suppose that we can change lower class culture according to plan. If we know how to change culture, why not do it directly with the lower class instead of having to change ourselves first? Well, the one thing that we can do, I think it offers little hope of success, except possibly in the very long run, the one thing we can do is offer the lowest income and least advantaged group enlarged opportunities for work, for self-improvement, for education. Most of these opportunities will not be accepted. We shouldn't expect much of this. But it seems to me that the problem is we have nothing else to offer. We don't know what else to do.
Listening to recorded highlights of the Harvard Law School Forum. Tonight's subject was $50 billion. For what? The federal welfare program. The Harvard Law School Forum is another Voice of the City feature of WHDH Radio News and Public Affairs.